A quick explanation before we get going with this episode. What you're about to hear is the first half of a longer discussion, which we're going to spread over two episodes. Emma came into the studio to talk to us about her doctoral research in progress, something that she does once in a while, and discussed not only some quite knotty topics like epistemology, ontology, axiology, worldviews and paradigms, but then went on to tell us what the implications of that were for her research design. It was a long discussion, very interesting, and once we'd finished, we decided it would work better split into two halves. So what you're going to hear now is the first part of that discussion about worldviews and paradigms, axiology, ontology, epistemology, and we hope you find it useful and interesting. Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Duha and Tom Breeze. Episode 3, Epistemology, Ontology and Axiology. Hello everyone and welcome back to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, where once again I have got the easy job. Because all I have to do is be vaguely coherent in the first couple of minutes of this and then sit back and let you do all the work.
Well, I am sort of trying to adopt a position of understanding and sympathy for our string of guests that come through the doors in this position, having to talk about the thing that is their area of expertise or interest. Yes. So, you know, I better sort of practice what I preach and try and understand their circumstances better.
So here we are talking again about your doctoral study, your area of hopefully expertise and hopefully interest.
Definitely still interested.
Good.
Definitely wouldn't adopt the identity of an expert just yet. But maybe, you know, starting to get towards a position of understanding it better.
Yes. So for any listeners that have either not been following your journey as closely as they probably should or have not remembered, let's just remind ourselves what you are actually doing for your doctorate.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So I am interested in student drama teachers or pre-service drama teachers, pedagogical content knowledge development, specifically how they develop pedagogical content knowledge within a clinical practice model of initial teacher education, which is one that sort of privileges the knowledge that you develop as a beginning teacher in university and in school and brings both of those worlds in close proximity with one another. And it's all about sort of the integration, interrogation of different types of knowledge that help you to find a way of being a teacher and practicing teaching.
Lovely. Which is interesting for drama people, but is also interesting for those of us who work with student teachers, with new teachers. So of interest to all of us, you mentioned pedagogical content knowledge, and you've now got very good at describing pedagogical content knowledge. It's the one with the famous quote where Shulman says in a word and then proceeds to use 14 words.
Yeah, he annoys me every time because I know it's coming up, that sentence. Yes. I'm like, oh, damn it, you didn't say it in a word, Shulman.
So come on then, deploy, what is PCK? You can tell us all again.
Okay, I do like saying it in his words though, however. So pedagogical content knowledge embodies the aspects of content most germane to its teachability. So the kind of subject knowledge that you extract from a big area that you're about to teach that you think is going to be most important that you teach. You can't teach everything about everything. So you sort of, you break that down to the content that's most germane to its teachability. Within the category of pedagogical content knowledge, I also include, I, Shulman, that is, for the most generally taught subjects in one subject area, the most useful forms of representations of those ideas. So we're thinking about pedagogy now. So we've got subject knowledge, we've got pedagogical knowledge. The most powerful analogies, illustrations, examples, explanations, and demonstrations, in a word or more, the ways of representing and formulating the subject that make it comprehensible to others. So the way that you teach it that helps others understand it. It also includes, and this is really important, I think, an understanding of what makes the learning of specific topics easy or difficult, And that includes the sort of conceptions and preconceptions that pupils of different ages and backgrounds bring with them to the learning. So the example I often give is that if I'm about to teach melodrama, which is commonly taught around about year 7 or year 8, in secondary schools in the UK, I can't teach everything about it. So I've got to sort of break that down to what is going to be most important, what's going to be most compelling for my learners. I've got to think about the learners in front of me and the sort of things that they may or may not know or understand about melodrama. They might recognise a few things about the word. They might know a few other forms of drama and theatre that are closely linked to it, like pantomime. They might know what it means to be melodramatic. And then I've got to sort of find different ways of helping them to understand and be able to perform and know the sort of skills involved and the knowledge involved in understanding melodrama a little bit better, being able to do it, experience it. But also, I know, because I've taught it quite a few times, the things that young people at that particular age, so we're talking sort of 11, 12, 13 years of age, are going to find quite challenging about it. For example, it's very exaggerated and over the top. And when those hormones start kicking in, or if you're just, you know, don't consider yourself to be a performer, you don't like performing, that can be quite challenging. So I know all of those things. That's a lot of knowledge that I've explained there. And this is what I think is so wonderful about this concept of PCK, is that Shulman refers to it as teacher's own special form of professional understanding. And I think that, you know, is just another step towards us realising and understanding how complex and complicated the mind of the teacher is and the sort of thinking that's going on when they're teaching. But also it gives us a little bit of a clue as to why it can be quite challenging when you're a novice.
Yes, the magic of being a teacher. We love PCK. We think it's wonderful. We still haven't got on to what this episode is going to be about. We are still currently in the bit which ought to have somebody saying previously at the start of it, because in a previous episode you told us about your lit review. In fact, I believe you submitted the previous episode to your supervisory team at one point, didn't you? So they could have a listen when they were out at the gym or out on a walk. You did your lit review into how it is that new members of the teaching profession actually come about kind of getting this magic. So just, you know, previously, what did you tell us about that from your lit review?
Yeah, okay. So I think I was halfway through the literature review when I did that podcast episode. And I think I'd come to sort of clearer conclusions from the literature by the time I'd finished writing it. And two things that really stood out. There are these two views that came through of the literature, in the literature of PCK. One, sort of viewing it as static, as a thing that you can teach to someone else, as not being dependent or sort of person dependent. It's sort of, and also not even being context dependent. It's sort of, I could teach you the PCK of teaching melodrama. So it's sort of a static view of PCK as a concept. And then dynamic view of PCK, on the other hand, was of particular interest to me because this is a sort of sees it as a sort of more situated cognitive thing that's going on, this sort of knowledge in use that's happening in the teacher's brain that might be happening when they're planning, it might be happening when they're teaching. So it's dynamic in that it's sort of reacting to lots of different things. And what this suggested to me as well was that there's sort of a process, this sort of dynamism to it suggests that there's this sort of a process of its development. And if we can investigate that, then maybe we can better understand how to support students to develop it. So that really grabbed me. And the second thing was that the literature told me that student drama teachers and student teachers in general, their PCK development differs between contexts. So when they're working at university and when they're on their placements in schools. And there are sort of different things that can sort of help and hinder PCK development in those two contexts that sometimes relate to the teacher educators they're working with. So if they're at university, someone like me, or if they're in a school working closely with their mentor who is also a teacher educator. So those things really grabbed me. And what that led to was some sort of questions, the lines of inquiry that arise from the literature. So I'm asking, after I've done that literature review, how do student drama teachers develop their pedagogical content knowledge? Like, is there something unique about how it happens for student drama teachers? Because I didn't find a lot of literature dealing with, in fact, I found one study that dealt with that. In what ways do school and university-based teacher educators, so me and the mentors, drama mentors out there that work on the programmes I'm in and those who work in similar programmes, how do they support pre-service drama teachers' PCK development? And I'm wondering, does the development differ between school and university contexts in a model like ours? And if so, how? So that's where I ended up.
Lovely. Right. So that's where we are as of now. So, listeners, there's a lot of talk about drama teachers there. There's a lot of talk about student teachers there. If you are not a drama person, or even if you're not an initial teacher education person, a mentor, whatever that might be, don't necessarily zone out at this point, because there's going to be a couple of things we're going to do, or rather Emma's going to do, and I'm just going to sort of sit back and admire the brilliance of it in this episode. Just to kind of throw forward to the thing which is going to come later, we're going to be talking about a type of research called participatory research, which is going to be of interest, I personally think, to people quite widely beyond the very, very niche groups of people that perhaps we've talked about up to this point. So stick around for that, because I think that will be very interesting. But before we even do that, we're going to be, or you're going to be, walking us through some quite knotty things which education researchers and other kinds of researchers have to deal with when they're doing this stuff. And hopefully that is also going to be interesting, because now you're at the stage, having come up with a massive load of exciting questions, that you've got to design your way into finding out about that stuff.
Yeah.
And lots of people that do masters or doctorates have probably been in that point.
Yeah.
And it's loads of fun. So, I say loads of fun in a special new definition of the words loads of fun. You're going to talk us through your research design.
I am. And I'm going to encourage you, Tom, to chip in as and when, because you've already been through this process. So a couple of these terms I know you've had to grapple with, but I thought it might be useful for listeners for me to sort of pull back the curtain about how I got from B to C, which is sort of where I'm at the moment. So in practical terms, I'm doing an EdD, so I do it by module. So the next module is, you've read the literature, so how are you going to investigate this issue that you've now read a lot about? How are you going to investigate? So I've got to propose, and I've got to pilot an aspect of my research design. Now, in my previous academic work, so when I did my master's, I realise now that there are a couple of steps that I skipped. You know, I haven't got time on this podcast to speculate as to why, but some listeners out there who are doing a master's may be familiar with the terms methodology and methods. When we're talking about your research methodology, we're talking about the sort of conceptual framework that you're using to solve the research problem. So you might be familiar with terms like case study, where you look at a particular case, you're looking at it as it is, you know, you're not trying to kind of solve it, you're trying to understand and what's going on in that particular case. You might have heard of action research. Teachers out there in particular might have heard of that, where you've identified a sort of an issue, a problem, something that's arisen in your practice, and you make an intervention, you design an intervention, you go through sort of a cycle of conducting that research and seeing if it actually worked, and you go through sort of various cycles. You might have heard, if you're sort of more in the world of science, randomized control trials, experimental methods. So all of those things are sort of like the methodology that you're using to investigate the phenomenon or phenomena that you're interested in. And then the methods, someone once said to me, you think about the methodology as the bag, the kind of toolkit, and inside the methods are the tools. So the concrete approaches or tools for addressing research questions. So for example, questionnaires you might be familiar with, they help you gather data, interviews, focus groups. There are lots of different methods that we can use to gather data to help us to address whatever the research questions are. However, something that I had to develop and write about for my EdD was my worldview as a researcher and the research paradigm that I am sort of adopting for my research. So you have to sort of, if you go straight to methodology and methods and you skip out these stages, hopefully what I'm about to explain is going to make it apparent as to, you know, what can be lost by doing that. So when I'm talking about worldview, a definition of this is a person's way of thinking about and understanding life, which depends on their beliefs and attitudes. A paradigm, and I'm taking this from a book called Doing Research in Education, is a school of thought or an intellectual tradition, such as sort of the tradition of natural science, the tradition of social science. So it's a school of thought or an intellectual tradition within which scientific concepts and practices operate. So if you're sort of adopting that tradition, then you're going to be using those particular contexts, you're going to be practicing, and you're going to be doing research in a particular way. So both of these things guide you as a researcher. If you've got your sort of story straight on what your paradigm is, what your worldview is, then everything else that you do in your research project, so the methodology you choose, the research questions that you ask and what they entail, who you think should participate in your relationship with them, what is study, how you study it, the data that you gather, how you interpret it, what you think count as valid findings, and even how you share and disseminate what you found, the conclusions, all stem from those things. I was like, whoa, that's pretty important.
Yeah, we've talked loads, haven't we, just sort of tangentially, I suppose, in episodes about how messy the world of education is and how kind of pupils and classrooms are not sort of nice, well-behaved, super scientific, super cut and dried things. We also have talked, or I have certainly made some pretty disobliging comments in the past about some of the quite obnoxious things that get said on edu Twitter. And I suppose when you're kind of saying that to me, you know, your worldview, your paradigm, the way you sort of see the universe works, I sort of find myself thinking it might do quite a lot of people quite a lot of good if they could possibly step back far enough to interrogate some of those things. And it might actually do a lot of us some good and might improve the way in which quite a lot of discussions are had.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, oftentimes we are bumping up against each other's worldviews, you know, and that can happen in the most sort of, I don't know, strange circumstances. You know, when you're talking at a party over a couple of drinks with somebody, you're bumping up against someone's worldview, and you know, if you understood a little bit more about how they came to adopt that worldview, what it entails, then you can sort of start to understand why they're saying what they're saying, why they're behaving the way they behave. And I suppose that's a nice transition to some terms that come up when you start to read about this stuff. Now,
the infamous ones everyone's frightened of.
I'm sort of like approaching this very, 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 very slowly with a lot of trepidation here, because these words in and of themselves can make you want to run and hide. Well, I say you. I mean, some people might hear these and go, oh, don't know what we're talking about, or do her. They're
some
absolutely
people
fine.
Love this stuff. Some people really geek out about this stuff, and some people are terrified about it, aren't they?
Yeah, it's quite challenging. Okay, so basically what I read is that to develop your worldview and your paradigm, you're encouraged to think about your epistemological, ontological, and axiological views. So I'm going to try now and unpick what I mean by those things.
Our remaining listeners.
Please don't switch off there. I'll try my best to explain these things.
No, it's good. It's worth it.
Now, I must say I'm standing on the shoulders of giants here. I've done quite a bit of reading about these things. So, you know, these are not my explanations. I'm sort of trying to put this in a way that is a bit of a synthesis of what I've read. So, and I can't say that I'm an absolute expert in these things. That's my disclaimer, and I'm sticking to it. So we'll start with ontology, because I read that ontology leads to your epistemology. So ontology, Greek words, for those of you who like your etymology. So it's a combination of onto, which means being, and logia, which is the study or logical discourse. So the study of being is sort of like the theory of existence. It's concerned with how we study and classify what exists in the world, and also how we can acquire that knowledge. And then to make it a bit more concrete, it sort of made sense to me when I read this question. So I found this question in a book which is trying to sort of encapsulate what you're thinking about when you're considering your ontology. Can education be studied from a detached position, So the world is happening outside of me. It can be objective. Or can it only be studied in collaboration with others? So meaning making is happening, is sort of codependent, and the view, that view of the world is sort of is a bit more subjective. Education researchers tend to lean towards, two other big words now, either a positivist, which can sort of be sort of generally termed as an objective stance, positivist, or constructivist, which is a bit more subjective. So they lean towards a positivist ontology or a constructivist ontology. And if you're a positivist, you might believe that the world is out there. So it's sort of separate from you and your sort of thinking. It exists separate from you. It operates in a systematic and lawful manner with myriads of discrete and observable events in which reality is separate from human sense making. Often a question that's asked that is aimed at determining your ontology is, if a tree falls in the woods, does it make a sound? Like, does it only exist because I hear it and I see it, or does it exist completely separate from me? Constructivists, on the other hand, in terms of ontology, believe that the world is semiotically, so through sign systems, constructed and reconstructed with different ways of meaning fused together through signs and symbols, amongst which language plays a central role. So the sky is blue because we've decided that blue is a thing. We've sort of constructed that. We're viewing the world in that way because we've decided that a word symbolises what we're perceiving. So it's sort of really dependent on the human that is perceiving that world. So it therefore needs to sort of be studied in collaboration with others.
And people get quite uncomfortable, don't they? Just to kind of jump in there.
Yeah.
Those two worlds feel very different, don't they? I mean, I always sort of think of the positivist one as being a bit like being like a physicist, you know, that there's stuff going on out there in the universe. And if you've got to find it out, and your own sort of feelings don't really come into it. You're trying to find the answer, and you've got to test it and that kind of thing. They can get quite uncomfortable with one another's sort of worlds, can't they, these two different groups of people? And if you are of a sort of not very nice way of going about things, you know, you can very easily get quite insulting about the other side of the fence, as it were. You know, you get these sort of people who come from a quite positivist worldview being a bit like, oh, all that kind of hippie stuff, all that sort of constructivist, it's all really hippie. It's not proper research because it's not in that cut and dried way. And similarly, you know, the people on that side of the fence can be a bit sort of rude about people in white coats sort of prodding things in dishes and stuff like that. It's so easy to get really sort of caricaturing, if that's a word, about those other worldviews. And you can see quite quickly how people start getting quite uncomfortable with the one that they don't inhabit.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I did read, and I've got a quote here, that, you know, paradigms will only take you so far. It's problematic. So positivism and constructivism are paradigms. They are that sort of way of seeing the world. They're problematic, and they should be treated somewhat more critically than it often is, for the reasons that Tom just explained. Because, you know, if you sort of, in fact, from a researcher perspective, you can tie yourself up in knots, and I certainly did, trying to perceive the way you want to research something as rigidly and strictly adhering to a particular paradigm. You know, and obviously, you know, it depends. Everything is dependent, isn't it? It depends on the situation. Like, you know, I wouldn't argue necessarily with a natural scientist that a positivist approach to, I don't know, exploring something biological, it wasn't the right thing to do, the right way to go. But I'm a social scientist, and I know that working with people is complex and is often codependent, and someone else's view and understanding of the world is going to be different to that of my own. And so who am I to say that there is one objective truth when it comes to social science? So that's where I sort of sit when it comes to social science and paradigms.
Maybe the grass can be a bit greener on the other side of the fence as well. You sort of think about the way some people really try to reduce quite a lot of stuff in teaching to very, very cut and dried things. And then other people don't like that. And they say, well, no, not in my subject, or not in my classroom, or not with my kids. And then you get other people sort of saying, well, this works. This, you know, remember the one, cognitive science says.
Yeah.
And it's a sort of grass is greener. Oh, I wish I could actually just be detached and have a positive answer. And oh, thank goodness, that's the answer. Yay, let's move on. So that's possibly the other risk, I suppose.
I think it is. It's like if you adhere too strictly and too unquestioningly to a particular learning theory, it's a bit like, you know, sticking too rigidly to a paradigm. So yeah, this is why I started going, oh, this ontology, epistemology, axiology stuff is floating my boat now, because I'm starting to understand the world a little bit better and who I am in it. So then we come on to epistemology. So this is derived from, again, Greek words, episteme or episteme, to know, and again, logia, so like the study of knowledge. It's concerned with the theory of knowledge with specific reference to the nature and forms of knowledge. So some questions that we might ask to sort of figure out our epistemology: what is knowledge? How is it acquired? For example, through acquisition or by participating, experiencing or direct instruction. How should we know what we know? So how should we go about knowing? And we can turn again to this sort of positivist, constructivists binary to better understand the differences in epistemology. So positivists will adopt the view that knowledge can only be attained by gathering facts in a systematic and objective manner. So one might therefore lean towards quantitative research in that regard, because you can measure it. It is a slightly more objective way of gathering that data. For constructivists, on the other hand, knowledge is a representation of the reality carried out by the researcher. So you're seeing the world in a particular way, because if your ontology is such that, you know, you're constructing what you're seeing, your reality, then you're seeing the world in a particular way, and you're representing what you're finding out in your research through that lens. It's the researcher who construes knowledge as subject to time-space configurations. So it's happening at a moment in time and place, and as a manifestation of social relations of power. And that's a bit grand, but what it sort of means is that, you know, if I'm researching Tom, or if I'm going into the classroom and I'm researching pupils, but I'm not talking to pupils, then it could be argued that I've got a lot of power there in constructing the knowledge about those pupils, because it's my position as the observer saying what I'm seeing and interpreting what I'm seeing. So it's really important that we think about these things, because as I said earlier on, it can then determine, well, what kind of questions do I ask? How am I going to work with the people who are going to participate in my research if I view the world epistemologically, ontologically, in these different ways?
And this is a classic one of people getting uncomfortable, isn't it? Because I know there are people who are very much what we, you know, some people call them, you know, quant heads or qual heads, people who would much rather deal in numbers, and people who would much rather deal in words and, you know, field notes and images and, you know, sound recordings and that kind of thing. And then you've got two questions. Which one are you most happy in? Which one is your happy place? And which one is actually the most appropriate one for finding out the thing you're trying to find out? And like, you know, you've said many times on the podcast that you're not a big fan of anything to do with numbers. Similarly, I hope she wouldn't mind me saying this, you know, I definitely had a conversation with our lovely colleague, Dr. Louise Allen Walker. She was working on a piece of research. She's very happy in the quantitative sphere, but she knew she needed to get into the world of qual a little bit. And she said to me, look, can you come on this project with me? Because I've never worked in the qualitative sphere. Mm. And I was like, well, I've never worked in the quantitative sphere. So yeah, I'll happily, you know, come do that because I don't mind. But she was a little bit reluctant to go into the qualitative world without a person who was happier in that world kind of with her on that project. And similarly, I'm sure you'd be the same if you were going into the quantitative world. But then there's the one that's right for the job as well.
That's it. Now, that's really important, this which one is right for the job, because in many ways that sort of rests on your axiology, which we'll come to in fact, let's just go there now, because I'll talk about what's got to do with PCK in a minute. So what I read is that your axiological stance permeates your ontological and epistemological stance. So what is it? So axia, again from the Greek, is the value or worth of something. So if you're, it's, in other words, it's basically your cultural values or norms. So it links to ethics because it asks what is the right approach to investigating a particular phenomena or thing that you're interested in. And this is where, you know, I think this is what perhaps takes you to another level when you start doing this in your research, because you're having to sort of dig deep and go into your sort of delve into your consciousness a little bit and go, okay, so why do I think it should be investigated in this way? Is there anything problematic about investigating it in that way? Who's going to benefit from investigating it in that way? Whose perspectives count in this approach? And what I read was that a good thing to do when you're thinking about this is to consider and maybe give an account of how your axiology, so your cultural values or norms, have come to affect the different aspects of the research process. So choosing your research topic. Well, I'm going to be honest with you now. I read about PCK and I was really struck by it because I thought, oh my gosh, this is something I feel that more people should know about, and I certainly didn't know about it. So I'm thinking about it from my own perspective there and going, oh, you know, this could be of value to others. And, you know, I'm sort of maybe making an assumption that other people don't know about it that I'm working with there. So I need to sort of carefully think about that, because I don't want to make any assumptions about the other people that I work with, either in the university or in school-based teacher education context. So when you start to sort of unpick what your cultural values and norms are, you can see a little bit more. It's about being reflexive. You can sort of see why you're behaving, thinking, coming to research something in a particular way.
This makes me think about when I was doing this on mine, and I got a sense of how uncomfortable it is when you discover a sort of approach to research that just gives you this sort of run for the hills kind of feeling. And it made me sort of realise what it must feel like if you are really down the sort of positivist end of the world, because I'm not, because I'm an education researcher as well. And, you know, I've sort of made my peace with the fact that a positivist approach is, you know, I'm kidding myself if I think there are sort of, you know, cut and dried, absolutely right answers to things. And I was sitting sort of somewhere a little bit further down. And then I remember telling you about this on the phone the other day when we were talking about this. I read about really activist approaches to research, you know, and when I was finding this stuff out, and, you know, people who were doing sort of research from a feminist standpoint or an anti-racist standpoint, and they were actually doing research in order to kind of throw off the shackles of oppression and all that kind of thing. And I'm, you know, all for throwing off the shackles of oppression and absolutely all for, you know, feminism and anti-racism. But when I was reading about taking an activist approach to research, where you were doing research, but you were also kind of taking that much of a political stance, it made my sort of it made me want to kind of just back off. It just didn't feel comfortable to me with my worldview. And it wasn't what I was going to be doing anyway with my research. But I was sort of reading about thinking, oh, gosh, you know, that's a bit strong for me. A bit strong for me. Back off kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it made me think, well, maybe that's what my position feels like to someone who's like super positive. Positivist, right down the other end.
Yeah, absolutely. What I read as well is kind of borne out in some of the stuff I've been reading, that your worldview, like the researcher has to be comfortable in the worldview that they've adopted, and, you know, that the paradigm that stems, that links to that, you know, that you've got to feel comfortable operating in that world. And I suppose comfortable is a bit of a loaded term, and it's dependent on various different factors. You said about a colleague who, you know, would be more comfortable in the qualitative world with a guide, with someone that's a bit more sort of comfortable in that world, got a bit more experience. So there's lots of different things that can help you be comfortable. But yeah, so going back to what you said earlier on, Tom, you know, the more you get to understand this stuff, the more you get to understand people who might adopt a different worldview and why they want to behave in a particular way, maybe how they react to you when you put forward a particular view about research or teaching or anything really.
This is why it's good to geek out about this stuff, really, isn't it? Because we often talk about this idea of stepping back, or that quote I talked about in my one a while ago, you know, being aware of the water in which you swim, you know, the fish being aware of the water in which you swim.
Yeah.
When we talked at the top of this about, well, we're going to be talking about our worldviews and our sort of, you know, our positions in and how we see the world, it's like, well, how on earth do I know what my worldview is? And it's actually a really good learning experience to go and find out about other worldviews or paradigms or whatever that you don't know about, and to just go, oh no.
Yeah.
That's a really good learning experience, because when you sort of bounce back from one that just doesn't sit well with you, then you start to become aware of when you feel comfortable in the one you're in.
Yeah.
And then you can become aware of the one that you inhabit.
Yeah, precisely. And I can give a concrete example of that, bringing it all the way back to PCK. I now understand a little better why, when I was reading some of the literature around dynamic and static conceptions of PCK, that I leant more towards dynamic, because I think I lean more towards an understanding of learning and teaching that is experiential, that is sort of co-constructed, that is participatory. You know, that doesn't mean to say that there aren't sort of things that can be acquired, that knowledge, the acquisition isn't important in learning, that, you know, there's certain things that you might not know that you need to acquire from somewhere else. But I think when it comes to PCK, because it is so complex, because the learners are going to be different every time, because it's so situated, the situation is going to be different every time. And coming back to probably something we spoke on the podcast about before, Doyle, like, about teaching is, you know, simultaneous. It's happening in history, in time and space. It's very complex. So because of all of those things, I lean more towards a dynamic conception of PCK. And I've therefore decided that I want to investigate that conception of it, as opposed to a static conception of it. And it might interest listeners to know that the static conceptions in the literature and people who've investigated it have tended to generally come from the worlds of maths teaching and science teaching. So isn't that interesting? Anyway, so I can sort of begin to sort of understand, by being brave and trying to understand what these terms mean, why I have operated up to this point in my research the way I have. So very, very quickly, it's probably worth the listeners knowing a couple of things about me, because this might illuminate how you can begin to sort of unpick your worldview, your axiology, your cultural values and norms. So a couple of things. I started out as a drama teacher in a secondary school context. I was there for 5 years. So I've got lived experience of what it means to be a teacher. And I also went through teacher education myself over a four-year period in a BA secondary drama programme. So that's quite a different route into teaching than a PGC, where you do it in 1 year. That said, there was a combination of learning about teaching theoretically and experientially. I had placements, but I also studied modules about drama and theatre. But my course was always about, you know, I'm learning about drama theatre, but with a view to teach it. So you could argue that sort of my understanding of pedagogical content knowledge was developing all the time on my type of course, because it was specifically a secondary drama teaching course. So that's important to know. Although I did do assignments when I was doing my BA, there wasn't a real focus at that point on sort of researching your own practice as a teacher. So my assignments tended to be more about drama and theatre and that discipline than, you know, how would I, I mean, there were some assignments that were about, you know, how might I teach this to pupils, but less so about, you know, what's happening in terms of teaching and learning in drama and how am I investigating that. However, when I went into my first teaching job, I had this opportunity to work with the Royal Shakespeare Company, me and a colleague. And part of that deal, because it was all about sort of better understanding how to teach Shakespeare and engage pupils in Shakespeare, part of that deal was that we had to do a postgraduate certificate through University of Warwick in teaching Shakespeare. And they told us that we had to use action research as a methodology to find a problem in our practice about, you know, what are my pupils finding difficult about learning Shakespeare and how am I going to address that? Let's have a go at it. So by the time I got to become a teacher educator in university, I'd already had a few things happen to me and that I had done and learned from that sort of convinced me about the power of research as a teacher and what it can do and help you in sort of empowering you as a teacher to sort of take control and ownership of your own learning and development as a teacher. So flash forward to now, I've been teaching teachers for 10 years. And during that time, IT was reformed. I'm sure many of our listeners will know this. And as part of that process, we had to come up with this new vision of how student teachers learn. A big emphasis during the reform was on the importance of partnership working. So we need to be co-constructing our programmes with schools that we work with. And every aspect of what we do, we need to be working together closely with schools, also when thinking about how student teachers learn. So got all of that dynamic, that change in status, power dynamic that's come through as a result of that. And this massive emphasis now on the teaching profession as being a research-informed, a research-led, a research-based profession. So teachers need to be researching, inquiring, and we've got programmes that reflect that. Okay, so why am I telling you all of this? Well, all of those things had a bearing on my axiological perspective. And therefore, before I even read about ontology, epistemology and axiology, I was like, I can't investigate PCK on my own. I can't be the one that decides how drama teachers develop their PCK because they work with mentors who know a thing or two or might know a thing or two about it. The student teachers themselves are experiencing it. They might be able to tell me a thing or two about how it happens in our model. You know, what if my perspective is wrong or not the full story or too reductive or too simplistic? So I was like, I need a methodology that isn't a top-down one, that isn't me going out and doing it to the people and all from my perspective. I need something that is a lot more sort of akin to the way we work in the partnership, co-construction, collaborative partnership.
So this is telling us the kind of person that you are. So let's imagine you were a different kind of person. Let's sort of, as we take stock, as we're about to move on to kind of what you're actually going to do, let's imagine you were a super positivist person. You felt that maybe PCK is a thing, almost like a tangible thing, that you can go and you can shine a light on and you can uncover it by going in as a pure researcher and going, there it is, it looks like this, it's shaped like this and it's this colour. This is what PCK is, I'm telling you it's that. You might be a little bit further away from that, a little bit more down, a sort of slightly more constructivist thing. And you would say, well, you know, I need to know what these student teachers and their mentors kind of think about it. I need to go in and I need to ask them stuff. I need to find out what they perceive. And I will sort of take all of that data and I will mash it all up and I will say, there we go. This is what these people think PCK is. And some of them think this and some of them are a bit more like this, which I think is probably quite similar to what I ended up doing, actually, on mine. Quite a sort of, let's go and let's talk to people and let's, you know, they'll have lots of input. And then in the end, I'll kind of go as this. But as we've just heard from your kind of, you know, talking about yourself and your values, and I say this with love, you're a person who would much rather take the more nuanced, the harder, the messier, the more difficult, the more sort of, you know, bramble infested and slightly difficult route to this stuff. And rightly so, I think, having kind of joined you on that journey as you interrogated all this stuff and ended up where you ended up. It's going to be a lot more messy than that, listeners. So let's find out what it is that you ended up wanting to do. And that is where we leave the discussion for this episode. Hopefully you found that interesting. No short slots this week because Emma did them at the end of our discussion, so you'll hear them in 2 weeks' time. We'll be back in a fortnight with the second half of the discussion. Hope you enjoyed it. Bye for now. You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Duha and Tom Breeze. Thanks to Emma for all the long words, and she'll be back in 2 weeks' time to tell us what she's going to do with them. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford, and the music is by Cameron Stewart. Technical support by Peter Lambin, and the studio manager is Adrian Rapps. We're on X at Talk Teaching Pod if you want to come and tell us what you think. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.